Ain't it great to be sober today? Come on, let me hear it. You guys can get louder than that. See, Jeff, that's how you get a response.
My name is Robert Zackel. I am an alcoholic. I am totally and utterly grateful and blessed to be standing before you today. It is an honor and a privilege to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would not be able to do this without Alcoholics Anonymous and each and every one of you, because whether you realize it or not, many of you in this crowd tonight have helped me in one way or another to achieve sobriety and maintain a new way of life. Tonight I've asked Rosalie to read the preamble, Bill to read how it works, and Kristen to read the traditions in that order.
Hi, everybody. My name's Rosalie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Rosalie.
AA Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problems and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Service tonight. Now what we're here for. This is my second year as chairman for the committee, and when I first got here, I had no concept or idea of how this thing worked and how to get speakers and whatnot. And somebody handed me a speaker CD and said, listen to this fella. I think you'll like him. And I listened to the CD over and over and over because it was that good. And I thought, wow, I got to have this guy here. And I got a chance to know him a little bit better tonight at dinner. And through our conversations at dinner, this guy is truly a miracle in his own self as far as what he's gone through before he got sober and what he's gone through after he's got sober. I'd like to give you tonight Bill Borchette.
My name is Bill Borchette, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm sober tonight through the grace of God, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and an awful lot of people who taught me how to stay away from one drink one day at a time. And for that, I'll be forever, forever grateful. And my sobriety date is April 8th of 1962. I got sober when I was 9. I don't know why people laugh. I only tell the truth as I see it. I want to thank Bob, Robert, and the committee and everyone else involved for asking me to come here tonight and share my experience, strength, and hope. I'm a writer by profession. And I've written much about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, much about Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson. But never did I dream that one day I'd wind up standing here on Founders Day in Akron, Ohio. What a privilege. And like the speaker Bob said before me, my heart is full. It can be nothing else when you're standing here in front of a bunch of drunks like you. Excuse me, should I say alcoholics? No, a bunch of drunks like you, because that's what I was. I was a drunk. To me, an alcoholic, as I grew up and I was raised in a family of drunks, But nobody ever called anybody in the family an alcoholic. That name was reserved for the Bowery derelict. Be driving in the car somewhere and somebody sees something, some guy sitting on a curb with a brown paper bag and he was picking lint out of his navel, and they'd say, there's an alcoholic. So in my mind, that's what an alcoholic was. He wasn't my father, because my father was simply a really bad drunk. He had five brothers, four of them died of alcoholism. Both of my grandfathers died of alcoholism. My grandmother, Lizzie McClintock, should have died of alcoholism. She died of meanness. So it runs in my family, and as Bob said, by the way, Bob, I really enjoyed your talk. Why don't we give Bob another hand? He did a wonderful job. And as he said, I don't know whether being raised in an alcoholic home or being the son of a man who was riddled with alcohol made me an alcoholic. I don't know. It doesn't make any difference. As my first sponsor told me that the only thing that counted was accepting the fact that I was and then doing something about it. It's the only thing that counts. You know, everything else doesn't count. I say my first sponsor because I've had four sponsors. My first sponsor, Betty, was my sponsor for 31 years. Then I had Jimmy from California for 8 years. Then I had Leo, and Jimmy died of heart disease. And then Leo died of cancer. And now I have my friend George, and he's very worried. Like Bob, I really enjoy humor, because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I hadn't laughed in a long, long time. As a matter of fact, Benny used to say to me that I had my head so far at my rear end, I needed a porthole in my stomach to look out, which I thought was very visual. You know, I've always been a kind of a visual guy, and looking out through you know why. Anyway, that's enough of that. Too much information. But I always enjoy sharing with you, even though you've probably heard this story 1,000 times, one of my favorite stories is about these two guys, Pat and Mike. They meet in Monahan's Saloon. And by the way, there is almost as many people here tonight as I used to drink with in Monahan's Saloon. It was a pretty busy place. And they drank so much together, they both become drunks, alcoholics, drunks. And they got so bad that they finally decided they'd give AA a try, and they got sober in AA, and they loved AA. And they had a sober over 30 years, and they're talking about, they love this AA so much, it's like being in heaven on earth. And they began to wonder whether there was heaven in heaven when they died. So they made a pact that whoever died first would come back and tell the other one whether there was AA in heaven. So Pat dies first, and Mike's in bed one night, and poof, Pat shows up. And he said, Pat, he said, well, Mike, I promised I would come back and let you know. He said, well, tell me, is there AA in heaven? He said, well, I have good news and I have bad news. Which would you like to hear first? And he says, well, give me the good news first. He says, okay. He says, not only is there AA in heaven, it's incredible. It's fabulous. It's unbelievable. They have these big open meetings every single day in heaven. And people from all over the world, famous people, celebrities, rich people, poor, they come and they speak at these open meetings, and it's just absolutely marvelous. And so Mike says, well, then what's the bad news? He said, you're speaking tomorrow night. A friend of mine recently told me I should stop telling that story because it's getting kind of relevant, you know. But there has to be A in heaven. I mean, it has to be, you know, because there's AA in here. So anyway, I want to share with you very briefly what it used to be like, and what happened, and what it's like now. That's what you asked me to do here. That's what we do here. We share our experience, strength, and hope. And thank God we do that, because when I finally came back to Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober, I needed to hear your experiences. Not just your drunk experiences, but I needed to know how you felt. Because this is where the problem was. in my heart, in my soul, and of course between my ears. Today the doctors are finally catching on. They call this a brain disease. Of course it is. It's been at a long time. But as I say, I grew up in this home where, you know, anger raged, resentment raged. My father would get terribly drunk and create some scene, and my mother starts screaming, and she didn't have anybody else to take it out on except her four children. And that's what happened. We get hit with a rubber hose and put to bed early, and if we did anything out of the way, it was, I have enough to do handling your father, I don't need trouble from you kind of thing. But this is before Al-Anon. Thank God Lois Wilson gave us Al-Anon, because it now gets families well. And it wasn't around then. And Alcoholics Anonymous was not very well known then. As a matter of fact, I think it was just a big joke on the radio and for comics to ridicule Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. But today, thank God, it's different. Not as much as it needs to be, but it's better. And so the way I used to occupy myself is I used to dream or pretend. I used to pretend that I was, you know, in another somebody's car going off to the beach. Or I'd pretend I used to work in a toy store and could have all the toys I ever wanted to have. And that led me eventually, even as a young man, to begin to put this stuff down on paper. And I would create stories. And in fact, when I was, I think I was 9 years old, I had my first poem published in a magazine. And this is simply one of the talents that God has given. He gives us all talents. We've all got them. And he only asks one thing, is that we use them. But anyway, things got really bad. And then I had an opportunity to get out of the house. I was in a Catholic school, and one of the nuns thought I had a vocation. She thought I might make a wonderful priest. Yeah, I know, she wasn't that bright. But anyway, I went along with it because she suggested that I could go away to this missionary seminary at the age of 13 years old. And I jumped at the opportunity. It got me out of the house. And I spent 5 years, believe it or not, studying to be a Maryknoll missionary priest. In fact, I even had myself so conned for a while, I thought that's what I was going to do. But it wasn't my vocation. And I should have recognized that when I used to love to do manual labor. We used to grow our own food and kill our own chickens and all that kind of stuff. And I loved it. The thing I didn't particularly care for was being in chapel at 5 o'clock in the morning with my head bowed, everybody praying in the darkness. And I'd look around and I'd wonder who they were praying to, because I could not get in touch with God. Now, I believe there was a God, but I could not get in touch with God for myself as a personal God. I never did until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And so my spiritual director began to notice that I wasn't paying enough attention to the religious stuff. And so he came to me one day and he said, William, I think someday you might make a wonderful father, but not in here. So he suggested I take a different path, and I did, and I came out. And I got a job working for a newspaper, and I began to date. And to make a long story short, I found this beautiful, beautiful, oh, raven-haired Italian girl named Bernadette. And I just fell instantly in love. And by the way, she had studied to be a nun. And once I got into her habit, it was all over, you know. So anyway, that's Bernadette there in the orange, sitting next to my host, Dane. Yeah. In March, we celebrated, this is incredible, this is Alcoholics Anonymous making this happen. We just celebrated 62 years of happy married bliss. And she had a mother who I really came to hate. I mean, she was, oh, God almighty, she was always praying for me, you know, always praying for me. And as a matter of fact, when I was drinking, Bernadette decided she'd had enough and she wanted to leave. And my mother-in-law, who was a terribly, terribly and wonderfully religious woman, said to her, you can't leave him now, he's a sick man, and he needs you, you got to take care of him. Well, then I finally got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was sober probably about 3 months. I think it takes us about that long to know everything, right? And then she really couldn't stand me, and she says, I got to leave him now. And Mama said, no, you can't leave him now. Somebody else will get all the good stuff, you know. So, she was a real philosopher, she was. But anyway, we got married, and what I want to do briefly is just share with you your story and my story of how this disease of alcoholic addiction invades every single aspect of our lives. It doesn't leave any stone unturned. Every single aspect of our lives. And that's what it did to me. And I had no idea. Because when I found alcohol, I thought it was my friend. See, I had just become a rookie police reporter for a newspaper in New York called the New York Journal American, which was then the largest evening newspaper in the world. There were 18 newspapers in New York. It was the heyday of journalism back in the 50s. And I had an incredible break. That's the story of my life. I was a young man who had incredible opportunities and drank them all away. Drank them all away. So many of us have done the same thing. It's unbelievable to this day when I see somebody get rid of the most important thing in their life for another drink. And I got rid of everything in my life for another drink. Now, if you had told me that back then, I would have just laughed, you know. But that's what happened. For another drink, I gave it all up. But anyway, I got married, and we moved into a small apartment, and I began to progress as a newspaper writer. They found out I could write, and they brought me in on Nightside Rewrite, where you write the stories for the first edition. And then they found I could really write, and they brought me in on Dayside Rewrite, where I was now writing stories for the, you know, seven editions of the paper. And I found myself working with some of the greatest writers you've ever want to know. I was working next to a guy, sitting next to, my typewriter was next to a guy named Joe Faulkner. He was the first cousin of William Faulkner, the novelist. And Joe was a much better writer than William Faulkner was ever, I believe. Truman Capote met him along the way. One of America's greatest writers who died of alcoholism and drug addiction. Tennessee Williams, alcohol and drug addiction. I mean, you name them. I'm not putting myself into any of their positions, but it doesn't make a difference who we are, what we are. It just grabs us and wants to kill us. But when I first had my first drink as a reporter in Brooklyn, something happened. I finally began to feel with a few drinks like I always wanted to feel. You see, when I growing up, I never felt comfortable with myself. I never felt comfortable among people. I always felt I had, it's called, as you know, low self-esteem, right? And I had it in spades. I never thought I measured up, never thought I was as good as. And now with a few drinks, I not only felt I was as good as, I was sure as the hell felt I was a lot better than you. Yeah, and I thought it made me a better reporter. I thought it made me a better writer. I thought it made me a better, you know, dater, better lover, better, you know, you name it. I thought it was my friend. And that's how it gets us. It crawls in and it sneaks up on us and it makes us a friend and then it begins to turn. And it turned on me with little things, not little, you know. I had my first automobile accident when I was pretty drunk. I was actually teaching a girl how to drive, you know. And she just happened to be on my lap behind a steering wheel and, well, I mean, I didn't know how else to teach her, you know. So, and so we dented the car a little bit, and so then. But I had 8 more accidents after that. After that, in fact, I had one accident that should have killed me because I was sent to cover an all-out fire in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. All the ships were going up, and I brought with me in my car a half bottle that was left of booze and a container of beer. And I got Frank Sinatra on the radio, and it's a soft, rainy night, and I'm riding under an elevated line train. And I forgot that at Bedford Avenue, Brooklyn, it goes back underground and becomes a subway. And I went head-on 80 miles an hour into the cement stanchion. And I came to on one of these things they push you around in the hospital on the way to the operating room with a big thing in my mouth. My mouth opened, my jaw was fractured, I lost some of my teeth, I bit a part of my tongue, and I had 6 broken ribs. And the only thing I remember before I got to the operating room, I asked the doctor if my car was all right. That's how drunk I was, you know. And so they patched me up, and 2 weeks later they sent me, you know, where do drunks go when they're in trouble? I went home and to Mommy, and Mommy nursed me back to health. And I never forget one Saturday afternoon, my dad invited all of my friends over to the house to celebrate the fact that I was getting well. And you know, drunks love to visit the sick and bury the dead because there's usually a bottle around, you know. And so my dad was passing it around, but when I came to him, he grabbed the bottle and he said, you shouldn't have any hard stuff with that wired up jaw. So he handed me a bottle of Christian Brothers Sherry Wine. And he said, this will ease the pain. Now, if you drink enough Christian Brothers Sherry Wine, you know, it's warm and sweet. You get pretty drunk and you get pretty sick. And if you ever tried to puke through a wired up jaw, yeah. Well, from personal experience, I can tell you the big pieces come out of your ears, you know. So I swore off Christian Brothers Sherry Wine and I continued on. And then, you know, Bernadette is an incredible human being. And I say that with all the love. I love her today more than I ever loved her in my life, because I know today through Alcoholics Anonymous what love is all about. You taught me unconditional love. That's what we have for each other. That's why we're all here. Because we'll do anything, go anywhere, anytime, any day, any night to help another alcoholic. That's why. And then I learned that. And then my sponsor told me to bring that home, and it began to grow at home. But anyway, things began to get really, really bad at the house and after this accident, and I began to get into trouble on the job. I went from a byline feature, I was 22, I became a byline feature writer. They were sending me all over the country. I went down to, you know, Alabama when George Wallace was barring the doors against the blacks at the university. I covered the first Sputnik shot up into space. Boy, am I dating myself. some big stories. Again, young man, great opportunities, and booze. And I drank it all up. And I wound up, because I got fired a couple of times by the city editor, and he wanted to teach me a lesson, so he made me the obituary editor for the paper. Now, by the way, there's a big difference between being the obituary editor and a byline feature writer. Big difference. Obituary editor comes in at 3 o'clock in the morning, and his job is to call up funeral homes in New York to find out what well-known people dropped dead that night, you know. Well, by this time, my booze had really progressed. My alcoholism has really progressed. I was now a daily drinker and practically a daily drunk. And now, with the shame of being the obituary editor, I was drinking all the time. And I had already drank up one home, and we were on the verge of drinking up another. And so I was so busy drinking that I couldn't afford to call a funeral home. So I had no time. So I would tear the obituaries out of other newspapers, you know? And I would paste them up on a piece of paper and send them into the composing room. This was before computer type. And now we're printing obituaries of guys who died a couple of days ago, you know? And I was getting notes in my mailbox in the city room from the editor saying, we want fresh obits. And I'm saying to him, what the hell is a fresh obit? You know, I mean, the guy's dead, right? So we printed one with a guy who died 4 days ago, and I knew I was going to get fired again, maybe for good. So I quit. I had a friend of mine with this weekly news magazine who, you know, he was always inviting me to come over and join him, and I finally did. I called him up and went to work as a feature writer for this weekly news magazine. That job lasted 3.5 years. My newspaper career lasted 8. This lasted 3.5 because my drinking was really progressing. And what happened was I wound up covering a convention in political convention in Las Vegas. And I was there 4 days, drunk 3, and never covered the convention. And so what do you do when you're in trouble? What does an alcoholic do when he's in trouble? I got drunk. And I went back down to the bar at the Riviera Hotel. Never will forget it. And there was a guy at the bar, a very well-dressed guy, and he told me he had been at the convention. And he was as loaded as I was, but he did remember, he thought, some things that happened at the convention. So I interviewed him, you know. So two drunks interviewing each other. And But I did have some press releases, so I wrote a story, called it in, and they called me back about an hour later and said it was one of my better pieces. Yeah. Except I was quoting people that I had never met, and they complained to the magazine, and I got fired. So anyway, what do you do? And I then went to work for a radio station in New York, WOR Radio. And that lasted 6 months because deadlines of radio, you know, 9 o'clock news, you got to have your copy in before 9 o'clock. And I wasn't good at meeting deadlines, you know, so you can't broadcast the 9 o'clock news at 9:05. So they fired me. And then I got a job with a little PR firm in New York. Nice guy ran it, Abe Schechter. But that didn't last me very long because what happened is they gave me an office with no windows. You should never give an alcoholic an office with no windows, particularly when he takes a three-hour drinking lunch. Because I come back from lunch about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm in my office and with the door closed, and my boss opens the door, and he steps back like he's shocked. And he says, God, if I light a match in here, we'll both be dead. So and then he fired me for drinking on a job. I wasn't drinking on a job. I was just bringing it with me into the office. At the age of 27, I became unemployable in the media business in New York. Even in a city of 8 million people back then, you can get a bad reputation, and I did. In the meanwhile, things were going apart on the home front. I had already walked away from God because God was not answering any of my prayers. I don't know if about you, but I used to give God directions, you know. If you do this for me, I'll do that for you kind of thing, you know, quid pro quo. And of course, I figured if there was a God, he'd answer me, but he didn't. And so things got very, so we lost the second house and we moved in. We had no place to go. I was dead broke, deeply in debt. So we moved into my wife's mother's basement. And we slept on two cots behind the oil burner so that we were always warm. And the kids slept in cribs around the walls. You know, I can laugh at it now, but I hated it. I hated myself for it. I was ashamed to look my wife in the face. I was always filled with anger, which was a reverse of shame. And I hated even coming home to that basement. And every time I did come home, to go to the basement, you had to walk through the side door down the stairs. And if you had to pass the dining room. My mother-in-law was always sitting at the dining room table praying. And now when I say praying, I don't mean just mumbling. She had the New Testament, the Old Testament, and the lives of the saints. She had two stacks of prayer cards like that and two sets of rosary beads. Now that's praying. In fact, that's almost a professional prayer, you know. And I know she was praying for me, and I took umbrage to it. I really did. And drunk as I was, I would stand there swaying, and I would start swearing at her. Who the hell needs you to pray for me? On and on and on. And Mama just kept on praying. Here was a woman who was seeing what I was doing to her daughter and her grandchildren, and she never said a word to me. Just kept on praying. That's why I'm standing here. Mama prayed me here. She really did. She prayed me here. But anyway, things got so bad, and it came to a head. One day, my wife never knew where I was. You know, I was always out panhandling from buddies, you know, trying to borrow money. You know, $10 till next Friday kind of thing. And I'd frequent bars, get to know the owner of the bartender for 4 or 5 days, and then make believe I was supposed to go to the bank, and then they'd cash a small check for me. And that's how I kept on drinking, and because I was running out of places to borrow money. Our oldest daughter, Judy, got very sick. She had an infection in her kidney. Had to be taken to the hospital. And Bernadette called me. She knew where I was that day. A businessman had called me, and I hadn't heard from him or seen him in years, so he didn't really know what kind of shape I was in, but he was staying at a club in Manhattan, and he invited me over. He wanted to talk to me about something, and I thought I could put the arm on him. And so she knew I was going to be there, and she called me and said that she had to take Judy to the hospital, would I meet her at the hospital. And by the time I got to the hospital, I was drunk as a skunk, and I fell out of the cab, and all I remember is her screaming and crying and begging me not to go into the hospital to see our child. On the way home, she said she hadn't eaten, and so we stopped at a Chinese restaurant. She says I ordered 9 drinks. Probably did, because I no longer ordered one drink at a time wherever I was. But here's what I do remember. I remember her looking at me. I didn't mind when she screamed and hollered. You know, we get used to that, you know. We deserve that. But every once in a while, she'd look at me, and she did this night. She said to me, "Why? Look at you. Why are you doing this to yourself?" She was asking me a question I couldn't answer myself. Why? So many nights I'd come to in blackouts in these, you know, rotten saloons and look in the mirror and ask myself the same question. What's going on? Why? Why don't I just go home? Why don't I just do this? Why don't I just do that? I had tried many things to stop drinking, but none of them worked. But anyway, when she asked me this night, I broke apart. I really did. I just broke apart emotionally. And I reached out for the first time to someone for help, and that was my wife. I said, "There's something wrong with me, and I don't know what it is. I feel like I'm going crazy." Now, you don't say anything like that to Bernadette, because Bernadette, you know, is not just a listener. You know, she believes that if there's something wrong, you do something about it. Me, if there's something wrong, well, just don't pay attention to it, you know. Well, that's the way I used to answer my mail. You know, I get letters from the IRS, and I turn them upside down on my dresser, you know. All my bills, turn them upside down. If I hadn't heard in 30 or 40 days, I'd throw them away. That's why I hadn't filed income tax in 8 years, you know. And I was always afraid somebody was going to show up at my door and put me in jail, you know. But anyway, this night when she said that. But anyway, when I reached out for help, she called our family doctor. And she said to our family doctor, because she shared this with me, she said, "My brother-in-law has got a problem." The shame, right? Shame. And my doctor said, "What has that bum of a husband done to you now?" See? He knew. And he suggested that I go see a psychiatrist. And he made an appointment. And the following Saturday afternoon, I found myself walking to the office of Dr. John Brancato, a little skinny, pencil mustache kind of a guy with half glasses, and no couch in his office. I always thought you lay on the couch when you go to see a psychiatrist, right? Tell him how your father beat you and all that stuff. But I came prepared, because I stopped off at Fred Funk's saloon to get ready. You know, you always got to get ready for big stuff, right? So I had about 8 shooters, and by the time I walked into his office, I was ready. And I remember swearing in the mirror at Fred Funk's saloon that I'd tell this guy the truth, whatever he asked me. And I did, you know, my truth. And I remember he sat me in front of his desk, because he had no couch. So I laid my belly, by this time I weighed about 330 pounds, you know. So I laid my belly on his desk. And I remember he looked at me and he said to me, "What's your name again?" I said, "Bill." He said, "How old are you?" I said, "I'm 27. He said, "What the hell are you doing in a psychiatrist's office at 27? I said, "Because I think I'm going crazy." And he says, tell me why. And I began to share with him some of the things that had happened to me, you know, during my drinking. Losing jobs and, you know, waking up in subway trains and checking out of places that I didn't even remember checking into, stuff like that, you know, automobile accident. Then he stopped me and he says, "You drink a lot, don't you?" And believe me, I didn't know why he asked me that question. Looking back, it was probably because I was breathing on him. That's probably why, you know. And I said, "Well, what do you mean by a lot?" Right? And you ask an alcoholic, you know, "You drink a lot?" "No, a few now and then, you know." He said, "Well, let's take a look." He says, "Do you drink what? You drink with your friends on the weekends?" I said, "Yeah." "Beer?" "I get beer." "Oh, okay. You ever drink beer on Mondays or Tuesdays?" I said, "Yeah." "You ever drink beer on Wednesdays, Thursdays, or Fridays?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you ever drink anything else from beer? Do you ever drink any scotch?" I said, "Yeah, I like scotch." "Do you ever drink any rye?" I said, "Yeah, rye is a good drink." "Yeah. Do you ever drink any vodka?" "Yeah, I like vodka. It's really good, really good." "How about gin?" "Yeah, gin and tonic in the summer. That's a good." "Yeah." "How about bourbon?" "Bourbon and water. I like that bourbon." And then he said to me, I'm not kidding, he said, "Do you ever drink any wine?" Well, I said, "Well, I don't drink Christian Brothers sherry wine anymore." And what he did, he was trying to do anyway, was to paint a picture of a guy who was 27 who drank every day in the week, anything he can get his hands on. And then he said to me, "Do you know what an alcoholic is?" Then I straightened up, because I knew the answer to this one. and I described the guy on the Bowery, right, with his pint in a paper bag, picking lint out of his navel. And he looked at me and he said, Bill, you're right, but that's an alcoholic in the final stages of his disease. He said, that guy wasn't born on the Bowery. He was probably born in a nice place like you, maybe even nicer. And through the use and abuse of alcohol, he wound up on the Bowery. And then he began, this guy had been a colonel in the Air Force. He knew all about alcoholism. And then he began to talk to me about the disease of alcoholism. And I suddenly began to get the impression that he was hinting that I was an alcoholic. And I got teed off. You remember when somebody suggests that to you? God almighty, who the hell? I remember thinking, this bum, who the hell does he think he is? I came to him out of the goodness of my heart, and here he is insulting me, you know? That's how I reacted, you know? And he noticed it. And in fact, he backed away a little bit, you know? But then when he said to me, Bill, if you are an alcoholic, and I think you are, by the way, he said, there's not much a psychiatrist can do for alcoholics. There's not much I can do. You know, it costs you $50 a visit. This is back in 62. And if you want to keep on drinking, you're going to need that money. You know, he was very straight guy. I got so teed off because he was so honest, you know. But then he said, if you really want help, I know some people who can help you. And he opened up his Rolodex and he wrote down the phone number of the Intergroup office of AA in Manhattan. And he said, if you really want help, go see these people. They can help you. I took the number, put it in my pocket, and then I left. And I was really, really upset because I knew I needed help. I wanted help. So I stopped at Fred Funk's saloon again to have a few more shooters because now I had to figure out how to explain to my wife what this guy just said, you know? I used to always do that, by the way. I don't know about you, but I used to think I could think better with a few drinks. You know? Reminds you of the story of the guy that, the drunk that walked into the saloon and he looks up and over the cash register, there's a big bowl full of $20 bills, you know? He says to the bartender, what are they for? He says, we're having a contest. You got to take $20 to enter. And he says, oh, what do you got to do? He says, well, three things. He says, see that 400-pound bouncer over there? You got to walk over one shot, you got to knock him out. He said, I'm a little guy. I don't know if I could do that. What else? He says, well, upstairs we've got this lady, kind of elderly woman, and she hasn't had any loving in a long time. And you got to make a little love to her till she screams with delight. So I don't know about that. What else? He says, well, in the back room we got a pit bull with a bad tooth. And you got to get a pliers and you got to pull the bad pit bull's bad tooth. He says, that's kind of dangerous. Wow. Oh, I don't know. So he starts drinking. And after about 8 or 9 shooters, he throws his $20 on the bar. He says, I'm going to enter the contest. So he takes off his jacket, he walks over to the bouncer, boom, one shot, and knocks him right out. He says, now I'm going in the back room. He staggers into the back room, and he hears screams and howls and otters. He finally comes staggering out, and his clothes are half torn off, and he's cut and bleeding. And he says, all right, now where's that old broad with the bad tooth? That's... That's the way I used to be. You know, I used to think I could think better with a few drinks. I couldn't. Anyway, my wife hates me to tell that story. I promise I won't tell the other one, okay? So anyway, I finally get home from Fred Funk's. I sit down on a couch, on a cot, behind the old burner. She's sitting on the other cot, and I said, she's very anxious. What did the psychiatrist say? What's wrong? What's going on? I said, well, you got to understand. I said, he thinks I'm an alcoholic. She said, what? He thinks I'm an alcoholic, but you won't have to understand what he means by an alcoholic. So I paraphrased. I said, he thinks an alcoholic is usually a very, very intelligent person. Isn't that right? I mean, just look around, right? But he said, the most important thing is an alcoholic is a very sensitive person, see? And what happens is when they get upset, they have to reach for a drink. So he told me to tell your damn mother to lay off me, and you lay off me too, you know? And she said, well, what else did he say? Now this you're not gonna believe, but you can get the testimony right here. he wants me to go to something called AA. And she says, how is American Airlines going to help you? Swear to God. Yeah. I said, no, it's not American Airlines. It's something called Alcoholics Anonymous. It's got to do with drinking. Then she lit up. And she says, are you going to go then? You're going to go, right? Yeah. I went over to New York. It's a big guy named John. We were talking about Ed tonight at dinner, Ed Mutin. This guy was almost as big, about 6'7", 6'8". And he was volunteering, and he had this brown plaid and sports jacket on. And he stood up, and he stretched out his hand as I approached the desk, and he says, my name is John. I'm an alcoholic. You got a problem with alcohol? I said, no, John, not me, but there's a psychiatrist back in Queens that thinks I do, and he sent me over here for some information. Every time I say it, it sounds so stupid. But, because it was stupid, you know. And Ed, John knew right from the, you know, moment, because he could smell me too, you know. He said, I'll tell you what, you want information? I'm going to take you to an AA meeting tonight. You get all the information you want. I said, well, wait a minute, this is Saturday night, right? Yeah, he said, I'm busy tonight, John. Why is Saturday night so important to drunks like me? I don't know. I had nothing to do but drink, right? So he said, I'll tell you what, and this is where God stepped in. You know, now God is always here. He's right here. He's God, right here. And all he's doing is waiting for us to give him a little opening that he can squeeze in and help us, okay? So now comes the opening, because John stands up again and he opens up his wallet and he hands me his business card. Now, by this time, I owed Beneficial Finance Company, Local Loan Company, Household Finance Company, First National City Bank, you name it. I was $62,000 in debt and couldn't pay a nickel. So Ed hands me his card and he says, anytime you go to a meeting, just call me up and I'll take you. I said, okay, thanks, John. Started for the door, glanced at the card. John so-and-so, Vice President, Chase Manhattan Bank. I said, wow, I got to get to know this guy. Oh, geez. Great manipulators, aren't we? So I'm back to the desk. I said, John, I think I can make it tonight. I'll move some things aside, you know. So he took me to my first meeting, but I wasn't ready. I was not ready to be an alcoholic, you know. You know, and you don't have to admit you're an alcoholic. All you have to do is die. Or worse, live with it. Worse, live with it. You know? So anyway, I didn't make it the first time around. But I did come home from some meetings and told Bernard, I'm glad I went. And she said, why aren't you going anymore? I said, because I've learned what I need to learn. She said, what did you learn? I said, I learned that someday if I ever kept drinking the way I was drinking, I could have a lot of trouble. And here she's sitting on a cot behind an oil burner. She looks around the basement. The kids sleeping in these cribs. She looks at me, and then she gets and she walks upstairs. I was so sick, I didn't know how sick I was. It wasn't until the following March, 1962, when I came to in a really flea bag place, you know, $2 a night, $3 if you want a sheet on a bed. Place smelled of everything, you name it. And I decided I had it. I was going to kill myself. At 28 years old, I was now in trouble with the DA from bad check charges. I used to write a lot of bad checks. And I thought I had a wife that hated me, children who were afraid of me, couldn't get a job, blah, 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 blah. You know that self-pity stuff. You've been there, you've done that. That's where I was. But God had other ideas. Instead, the other thought that hit me was, I'll get out of their lives for good because they'll be better off without me. And so I went home to pack a little cardboard suitcase and leave. And as I was about to go back up the basement stairs, my wife looked at me and she said, before you leave, do you think you owe me one last favor? I said, I guess so. If I can, what is it? She said, for God's sakes, Bill, why don't you give AA another try? From a woman who I thought hated my guts. Why don't you give AA another try? I couldn't handle it. It was like a doctor saying, you really don't have cancer, you know? So I went down to the City Line two blocks away and I had a couple of guzzlers and finally looked in the mirror and looked, you know, mirrors don't lie. When you look in the mirror, you get the truth back, right? And the truth said, you just can't go on any further. Either you go back to that hotel room and jump out the window, or go to some loony bin, or wind up in jail, or try AA again. So I tried AA again. Bernadette called. Got a hold of some guy. She's a saver. She had saved a card that the guy had given her. And the guy asked me a simple question on the phone. He said, Bill, I hear you're in trouble. Do you want to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, please, Joe, please. And that Monday, April 8th of 1962, Benny Michelson, a little roly-poly jeweler from Brooklyn, New York, and six other guys showed up in front of my basement in his big old Packard car. You know, those big old Packards. You remember those Packards, George? They could seat eight guys. Even with seven in it, they squeezed a fat guy like me in the back seat, you know. And off we went to a meeting where my life began. And that's not being melodramatic. You see, the reason I wanted to die was because I didn't know how to live. And if we stop and think about it, that's why we also drink. I just didn't know how to live. I just couldn't put two and two together. Nothing made sense to me. But now you began to teach me. Benny Michelson began to share with me all that he had learned, all that he did, all that he shared to help me stay sober. This Jewish jeweler shared with me his higher power. See, I believed I grew up with a God that was a very angry God, that really didn't love me like, you know, that good nun said. I always thought he was just this big old guy with a big gray beard sitting up on a big throne in heaven with a big book in his hand, writing my name in it every time I did something wrong. That's not God. That's not God. God is a very loving, loving person. God, Benny used to say to me, he forgave me things even before I did them. The reason he could prove it is that I was standing in front of him sober. That's what God does. God loves us so much, he just wants nothing but good things for us. And my journey began. My journey began. So I told you what happened. And now I'm going to share with you a little bit about what it's like now. I was talking with Dave earlier about I don't know how we got into the conversation, but Benny used to say to me, no, it wasn't Benny either, it was Jimmy out in California, that I'm so willing to share all of my garbage with you, and we all are, right? We're all willing to share all kinds of garbage with each other, right? And he used to say to me, then why aren't you so willing to share all the good things that have happened in your life as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous? Why? And he knew why. Because I wanted to be thought of as this simple, nice, humble guy, you know? Bill, the humble guy. And Benny said, you were never humble a day in your life, for God's sakes, you know? He said, you had the biggest ego I've ever seen. So why the hell don't you just admit it? Not just to me, admit it to yourself, you know? And so what? What difference does it make? There's a lot of us BS artists around here, you know, who like to embellish the truth. You know, even, as Bob said, in sobriety, right? We do that. Of course, you do, but I don't. Anyway, so he said, why don't you start sharing? And I began to, because what happened to me, I could have never dreamed this, envisioned this, and it just began to happen. Again, because God gives us talents. And I believe that what he wants us to do in sobriety is to use them. Not bury them, not store them, not put them away, to use them. And if you were like me when you first came to Alcoholics Anonymous and began to get sober, I had no more aspirations. I had basically given up on myself. I had lost everything, it was gone. I thought maybe I could get just a nice little job somewhere, enough to pay the rent, enough to support the wife and the kids, maybe you get a used car, and just live that kind of soft, quiet, comfortable life. God didn't make me for that. And I had to face that. God made me to use the things that he gave me to use, and I began. And Benny told me, he said, because if you don't, you'll be the unhappiest drunk, and you won't even be a drunk. You'll be a real drunk. You'll be a sober drunk. Be a real drunk. And so I began to use them. I got back into the media business when I was sober a short while. We had to move to Nashville because I couldn't get a good job in New York, but in Nashville I got a terrific job. and got involved in all kinds of things in the Chamber of Commerce, and did a lot of writing and got involved in music with Johnny Christopher in the country music business. Wonderful. Then I moved to Cleveland, lived in Shaker Heights for a couple of years, got involved in the burgeoning conglomerate, did a lot of writing, handled all the communications. And then four guys in Cleveland invested enough money in me to start my own business back in New York. So I came back to New York and I started a communications company. It was 1968. I was sober 6 years. But I was working on my sobriety. I was working, Benny had taken me through the steps and I was putting the steps in my life, and I was trying to live a sober, decent life. I was trying to be a good husband, a good father. I was trying to the best of my ability. Didn't always make it, like Bob said, but I tried. Because Benny used to say to me all the time, Bill, all you can do is your best. You can't do any more than your best. The problem with us alcoholics is we think we can do more than our best, and so we get down on ourselves. If you can go to bed, he used to say, every night and say to yourself, did you do the best you could today? Then you have a good night's sleep. And forget about all this other ego stuff that I could have done this, could have done that. Baloney, baloney. All I can do is my best, and that's what I try to do, my best. And so I started this communications business, and I built a nice company, it was very successful. And then I was dealing with a lot of investment bankers. And one of them came to me one day, and Larry Fox, I never will forget, and he said he was putting a company together. And he wanted me to be involved in it. He said he was putting together an independent motion picture production company, a company that could make pictures independently from the studios. Of course, the studios then controlled everything. And he said, I'd like you to be part of it. He said, I'll buy your communications business. We'll merge it into this. And I got three other guys. I want you to meet them. And if you guys work it out. So I met the three guys, and I loved them. They were terrific guys. And so we started a company called Artists Entertainment Complex. And now this drunk, you know, who couldn't rub two nickels together, but still loved stories, still loved to dream, still loved to pretend, used all of that stuff with the talent to write that God had given me to become someone in the motion picture business. And the first movie we made, some of you may remember if you got my color hair, it was called Kansas City Bomber, and it starred Raquel Welch. And back then, excuse me, Raquel Welch was really something. If you saw the Shawshank Redemption, you know, the guy had a picture on the wall, right? And watching Raquel Welch in these black, tight-fitting leather pants skating around this rink was like having a spiritual experience, is what it was, you know. It's incredible, you know. So I fell in love with the business. Yeah. Then I had a friend of mine, Peter Moore. Some of you may have read some of Peter's books. He's a great, great writer. And he and I had covered the Knapp Commission together in New York City. It was an investigation of dirty cops. And the undercover cop that was breaking it wide open was a guy named Frank Serbico. And they tried to kill him twice. So he fled to Switzerland. And Peter went over to Switzerland and got Frank's rights and came back to write a book. And so we had lunch and I told him about our independent motion picture production company. And he said, well, if we can make a deal, let's make a deal. So we got Dino De Laurentiis. You may have heard that name. He was a big motion picture financier. And he put up the money, provided we get a young actor who had just done his first movie called Panic in Needle Park. Great, great drug movie. This guy named Al Pacino. And so we got Pacino to play the role of Serbico, and that broke us into the big time stuff. And as a matter of fact, if I may just say that it enabled us to, by this time, you know, Bob was bragging, he's only one up on me. When I got sober, we had four children, and then we had five more. Because, well, he knows that a lot of things begin to work again when you sober up, you know, so. So we got. Bernard has a painful look on her face every time I say that. You know. Anyway, we have six boys, three girls, two boys in the program. Excuse me. And then we were fortunate. We bought a lovely home in Rye, New York, and things, you know, financially went well. But that's not really what this is really all about. What I'm trying to share with you is what sobriety can bring. Because Benny used to say to me in the early days of my sobriety, he said, Bill, if you stay sober, things will get better whether you want them to or not. They'll just get better. And they do. If there's anybody sitting here today struggling, don't worry about it. Feel good about it. We all had to do that. And we sometimes still do. But the best is yet to come. There's no way. There's no way not to have a wonderful life sober. There really isn't. You know, sure, you know, some of us may not have what other people have and so on and so forth. Then we practice acceptance and use the other tools, but we can accomplish. You know, Benny, he used to always say to me, this is a Jewish jeweler from Brooklyn, he used to always say to me, that God would not implant dreams if he didn't also give us the ability to accomplish them. And I've proven that in my own life. Because what happened after we made Cervico, one of my partners came in one day with a tear sheet from Life magazine about a young guy who had just robbed a bank in Brooklyn to get his lover a sex change operation. And it wasn't my cup of tea, but I thought it could be a good movie. So we made a movie called Dog Day Afternoon, again with Pacino. So we had a lot of fun making movies. In the meantime, Bernadette goes to a picnic. We're now living in Rye, 20 minutes from Bedford Hills, where Bill and Lois Wilson lived. Bill had now died. He died in 71. But Lois was still very much alive. And Bernie goes to a picnic at her house with some friends in Al-Anon and meets Lois, and they become fast friends. And then she asked me to come up and meet Lois, and I go up and I met her, and I couldn't believe. I just couldn't believe this lady. She was incredible. And she asked me to look around the house, and I went upstairs, and I'm sure many of people have been there. And upstairs, she turned into a museum of AA and Al-Anon, you know? Pictures on the walls and captions and catalogs of letters and cards from people all over the world thanking them for saving their lives. And before I got halfway through, I saw a movie, you know? And so I came back downstairs, and the first thing I said to this lady who I had just met, would you mind if I made a movie about your husband? You and your husband. But you can't. Lois is, she just smiled and she said, well, why don't we get to know each other first? But she had fallen in love with Bernadette. And by this time, they were traveling all over Westchester County and eating lunch together. And every once in a while, I'd bring him down to New York and we'd see a New York show together. And she became part of our family and we became part of hers for the next 15 years. And Bernadette was with Lois the day she passed away. She was a fantastic human being. And so I had this idea that I had never seen a really good movie about Alcoholics Anonymous. I saw a lot of bad ones. So I figured now it's time for me to take over the mantle from Bill Wilson. See, but he had just gone so far, you know, and Dr. Bob is now gone, you know, so we need somebody to take this movement further. So I anointed myself, and you think I'm kidding? I'm not kidding. Man, you just light one match and this ego goes up in flames. Anyway, I already saw this big movie, feature film, you know, by William G. Borcher, blah blah blah, and as a matter of fact, I wrote a script. I took it out to my friend. I had a friend who was one of the directors of Paramount Movies. And his nephew ran a studio named a guy named Peter Goomba. And I showed Peter the script. And he said, I love to make drunk movies. Drunk movies are very exciting. I love to make drunk movies. He said, I want you and your wife to go to Vegas, spend a week on me, come back Monday, we'll make a deal. Great. Come back Monday, and he said, well, I'm ready to make a deal, but I've read the script, but we got to change it a bit. He said, of course, it's too dull. He said, we got to make this guy this drunk. What's his name? Bill Wilson? I said, yeah, Bill Wilson. He's got to make him really exciting. I mean, we're going to have him running up bare-ass naked, running up and down hallways, chasing broads, and I mean, all that kind of stuff. And I said, Peter, didn't you read the script? This is a spiritual movie. He said, spiritual movie? I don't make spiritual movies. They suck, you know. So, but I had promised Lois Wilson two things. Number one, if she was still alive, I could not use her last name because of anonymity. And secondly, that whatever happened, I would tell the truth of the story. She was a very smart lady, and she knew you had to put two people into one character and so forth, but she just wanted the truth of the story, how it happened. And we all know, most of us hopefully, know how it happened here, this weekend. This is where it happened. The birth of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I put the script under my arm, because I couldn't make it. And I tried a few other studios, they didn't want to make. It was too soft, they said, so. Okay, so, and by now, I'm going nuts because, my ego is shattered and my sponsor is laughing. And in fact, he threw the big book at me and said, blow the dust off it and get the hell back into it. He said, and you get active again with drunks, and I did. What I did is I started getting very much involved in a place called Casas Arena in Westchester County. I go up there a few times a week and work with Joe LaPiccolo's drunks. Joe LaPiccolo ran the place, and I love Joe. He's passed on now. And I'd just sit around and talk and share, and they'd share with me. And the cook was a guy named Ed. And I'm gonna wrap this up, because now I'm going to share with you my God story. This is how God works for me, and I believe for you in this program. So anyway, Ed asked me to be his sponsor. So I said, glad. And so I shared a lot of things with Ed, including the script that I had written, right? Now, at Ed's first anniversary, he asked me to speak, and I did. And afterwards, he said to me, I've decided to follow your advice. I said, well, I don't give advice, Ed. He said, no, but you said to me that I probably wasn't going to be a cook in a rehab the rest of my life. I would have to find some better things to do with my, what should I do? He said, I decided I'm going to go to Hollywood and become an actor. And I said, for a minute, I kind of feared that, I might have influenced him with my background. And I said, make sure when you get there, Ed, you get into AA again right away, get a sponsor, It's good. Ed was a really nice guy, very strong personality and all, but he wasn't what you call a leading man type. He had one ear went west and one ear went east and his nose went south and, he had pockmarks and a few scars from a little, saloon battles and stuff, but a hell of a nice guy. And then he said to me, would you mind if I took your script with me to Hollywood, just in case I bump into somebody who wants to make it? I said, sure, Ed, because that's the way movies get made. A cook from a rehab goes to Hollywood with a script under his arm. Right? And one day he's sitting in a cheesy diner and he bumps into an out-of-work producer and he says to this producer, I got a great script under my arm. Would you like to make it? And the producer says, absolutely. I've been waiting for that all of my life. See? Now, I had to apologize for being a little sarcastic. But Ed got my point. He laughed, I laughed, and off he went. One Saturday night, Bernard and I are sitting at home and Ryan... We're watching Archie Bunker. Remember Archie Bunker? Yeah. And his house gets robbed. And he calls the police and two detectives show up. You know who one of the detectives was? Ed. Ed. Bernard says, isn't that Ed? I said, yeah, that's Ed. Oh. Another night we're sitting there and we're watching, remember the Sanford Sons, the junkyard show? Yeah, remember that? And the junkyard catches fire. And five firemen come rushing in with the hose. You know who the lead fireman was? Ed, right, Ed. Bernard says, isn't that Ed again? Yeah. He was going around Hollywood knocking on producers' doors and getting big parts in their shows. Then Ed calls me one day, never will forget it. And he's very upset and he's very angry on the phone. And he says, I just found out that somebody out here is trying to steal your movie. I said, what are you talking about? He says, somebody's trying to make a movie about AA. I said, well, anybody can do that. It's, public information and so forth. No, but you got Lois's special permission. You got special stuff. Well, I'm going to get to the bottom of this, he says. I said, okay, Ed. What he does is he finds out there's a company in Hollywood named Garner DeShow. James Garner, we just lost Jim last year. Fantastic guy. Loved him to death. James Garner and a guy named Peter DeShow, who was his right-hand man. He was the executive producer for the company. And they've been trying to make this movie, and they've gone through five writers, and they haven't come up with a good script. And Ed goes and visits their office, and he meets Mary Ann Ray, Jim's secretary, And she tells him the story, and because Ed was he was just such a personable guy, you know. And when she says we have five writers and no script, he takes the script out from under his arm. Here, read this, he says. You'll love it. She takes it home and she reads it. Believe it or not, she reads it. And she loves it. And she sends it over to James Garner. And he reads it and he loves it. And he thinks that Bill Borchardt on the script is a new writer that his partner, Peter DeShaux, had hired. See? So he calls up Peter and congratulates him. He says, I love this new script you've got, Peter. He says, what new script are you talking about? He says, this new script from this guy named Borchardt. He said, never heard of him. Never heard of him. And he says, if you read it, we're in trouble. We can't read people's scripts without their permission. And Garner says, read it and call him. See, they told me all this on the set, you know? So Peter reads it. And then, again, we're sitting at home in the kitchen, and the telephone rings, and it's Peter DeShaux. And he says to me, my name is Peter DeShaux, and I'm in trouble. I'm a partner of James Garner's, and we've read the script we got somehow. We don't know how the hell we ever got it, he says. I was going to tell him, a cook from a rehab. And he says, but we think it's really what we want. He said, but you wrote it as a big feature. Would you be willing to rewrite it for a television movie? We're doing this for the Hallmark Hall of Fame. I said, geez, I don't know, Peter. I'm kind of busy right now. But if you give me about 5 minutes, I think I can get around to it, you know. And we turned, he came to New York. We cut a deal. And I went down to the beach and rewrote it. And we called it My Name is Bill W. And that's how it got made. I'm going to tell you one more thing you won't believe, because I didn't believe it. I heard it 5 months ago. I got a call from Norman Stevens. Norman Stevens was the Warner Brothers representative, because the movie was made by Warner Brothers and Hallmark Hall of Fame. And he was the Warner Brothers rep, and we've been still good friends, Norman and I. And he said, Bill, guess what? He said, the Museum of Arts and Sciences, the Academy of Motion Pictures, ABC and the Hallmark Hall of Fame have just come out and said with their statistics that My Name is Bill W. has become the most watched television movie ever made. Yeah. That's because God made it. And I'm not being overly humble. You know, the truth is the truth, right? You can't ignore the truth, right? You know, when God was ready, when I was ready, God said, oh, no. You know, I mean, I still like what Bill Wilson did. We don't need you to interrupt that stuff, you know. So it didn't get done in my time. It got done in God's time. That's when things get done. They get done in God's time, you know. And when God was ready, he made a good movie, and I went along for the ride. But there was not enough in the time in a movie to tell a Lois Wilson story, which is even the more important story. Because every alcoholic affects at least seven people in their families. You know, the wife, husband, children, whatnot. And that story of Al-Anon needed to be told. So I wrote a book, and then we made another movie with Hallmark called When Love Is Not Enough, the Lois Wilson story. And with Winona Ryder and Barry Pepper. So anyway, I now share that stuff because I think it's, well, first of all, my ego is going to be as big as it is no matter what. You know, that's the way it is. I did manage to squeeze through the double doors tonight, but to get in here. But the reason is, I mean, don't take this the wrong way. I don't really care anymore what people think about me, you know, because I finally got to think pretty good about myself, you know, because I really try best of my ability to do the right thing most of the time, you know, and... But it's important for me to share all the good stuff that God does for us and just open the door and let him do it for you too. If you're holding back on a dream, don't hold back anymore. If you don't think something can happen in your life, try it. I mean, I've seen so many miracles in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was sharing with Robert that I've been told by some that I use the word miracle too loosely. And then I say, how else can you describe someone who comes here with no light in their eyes, nothing in their heart, little in their head, that are totally addicted to this poison of alcohol. And then we watch what happens. Then one day we look at them and we can't believe what their life is like. That's a miracle. There's no other way to describe it. Is there? No, no other way. And to close, I want to tell you just one more thing about my mother-in-law. We were living in Nashville, Tennessee. We're having Robert, our fifth child, in Nashville. Bernadette was really tired, really tired. And she says, could I ask Mama to come down and spend some time with us? I said, absolutely. So I went up to New York and got Mama, convinced her to come down. And I didn't have to convince her much. She loves children. She had 16, by the way, 16. 16 children. Only one boy. Imagine that, Anthony. I remember asking Anthony once, what was it like to grow up with all of those girls? You know what he said to me? He said, I didn't know until I was 15 I didn't have to sit down to pee. You know, so. I guess that can happen, you know. So Mama comes down. Mama comes down in Nashville. And that night she puts Bernadette and the kids to bed and, you know, gets everything tidied up. And I'm sitting in a den getting ready to do some writing. And Mama gathers all of her paraphernalia together. She's got her Lives of the Saints and the New Testament, the Old Testament, the sets of rosary beads, the prayer cards. And she's heading for my dining room now to do some praying in my dining room. And she sees me in the den. And she walks into the den. She was only, what, not even 5 foot tall, you know. But she was a giant spiritually. And she sits down, puts her stuff down, sits down next to me. And she says to me, Bill, she says, you know, all of my life, I read in the New Testament about all the miracles that Jesus performed. And then I read it in the Lives of the Saints, all the miracles that the saints performed. And she said, I've often wondered what it would be like to see a real miracle. And then she put her hand on my shoulder. And she looked up at me and she said, and now I have the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you. Thank you.
Keep it going for Bill. Keep it going. Bill, I want to thank you for accepting our invitation from the Founders Day Committee to come to Akron, Ohio. It's truly a blessing, and I'm honored to be a part of this program and to get to meet you today. As on behalf of the committee of Founders Day, we present you with this gift.